This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading for the last time from the first chapter of A Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1, by Sumner Mattison, M-A-T-T-E-S-O-N. Sumner has 18 chapters in this book about one fascinating person after another. And the first chapter is about Increase Lapham. If you've missed the previous three episodes I've done, go to the WDRT podcast archives, wdrt.org, and you'll be able to find out a lot more about who Increase Lapham was. Fascinating and multi-talented person, born in 1811. When we left Lapham last time, on September 5, 1858, he wrote, "Returned this forenoon in the same boat to La Pointe, where we arrived at 1:30, and set off immediately in a small sailboat for a voyage across Chequamegon Bay to Ashland. The sail across from La Pointe to the head of this bay was a very pleasant one, the wind being favorable. The long sandy point, Long Island, that separates this bay from the waters of the lake is a very remarkable one, partly covered with trees. It has a counterpoint on a smaller scale extending from Madeline Island." And then on September 6, 1858, he writes, "At Ashland, at the southern extremity of Chequamegon Bay, this morning we doffed our coats, put on red flannel shirts, overalls, boots, and so on, to prepare for a tramp of 10 days in the woods. Four men were engaged as packers, whose duty it was to carry large packs on their backs, much in the same manner as an Indian woman carries her child. These packs were to contain our beds, blankets, cooking utensils, and provisions. I carried a tin botanizing box and a mineral hammer and chisel. Colonel Cutter had command. Mr. L. F. Leopold of Cleveland, Ohio, was one of the party, and we were fortunately joined this morning by Professor E. Daniels, one of three state geologists of Wisconsin. With him, I am to explore the Pinoki Iron Range lying south and southeast from this place, the same that was discovered and described by Colonel Whittlesey in Owen's Geological Report. The journey was to be made on foot, as there are yet no roads made through these dense forests. A very good trail, however, has been opened so that the walking was easy. At 10 a.m. got started and walked over a gradually ascending plain, underlain mostly by the red marl. At intervals, a short distance is sand, probably an ancient lake beach. At Ashland, notice the marl lying in ridges as if thrown up by some cause, though this is not probably their origin. The trail leads directly south from Ashland on or near a section line, 1 mile east of the range line between ranges 4 and 5, west of the fourth principal and in Township 47 North. 6 miles brought us to Welton's on a branch of the Bad River, here called White River, which runs in a valley perhaps 100 feet deep, cut mostly in the red marl. The trees on this flat were conifers, poplar, thick almost exclusively. The bark of the white cedar is used to cover houses, also to form an outside lining or additional protection of log houses. Surveyors together use it to make a temporary camp under which to spend a night. It is also used in various other ways. Saw much balsam, Abies balsamea, with the little warts on the bark, under which was to be found the aromatic gum which gave name to this tree. At Welton's first saw the American elm trees, Ulmus americana. We learned of an adventure of Mrs. Welton with a large black bear which was very much disposed to make himself at home about the house, picking up such food as happened to be left within his reach. Not liking his companionship, she boldly shot him through the window of the house, though not until she had firmly fastened the door to prevent an attack in case of failure to kill. And as soon as the gun was discharged, she ran for the upper story of the house, hastily pulling up the ladder as further security against pursuit. Poor Bear, however, was too far gone to think of revenge. He was soon dead. We passed a large beaver dam and were reminded of the fact that these strange animals are still found in this vicinity. And I'd like to note here that beavers became trapped out. They were extinct in the eastern part of Wisconsin by 1730. And we are at 1858. So next letter is dated September 7th, 1858. And here he mentions something called epidote. An epidote is worth looking up to hear a description, E-P-I-D-O-T-E. A quick definition of epidote is a lustrous yellow-green crystalline mineral common in metamorphic rocks. It consists of a hydroxyl silicate of calcium, aluminum, and iron. September 7, 1858. Started early for a tramp of 18 miles. Six more than we walked yesterday, at 5 miles southeastwardly from Libby's, where we started this morning, we found the first trap rock in place in the bed of a stream, a branch of the Bad River, associated with what appeared to be altered sandstone. This last named rock contains much epidote, may be an epidote trap. Probably this epidote, the only indication here found of copper. This is called the Copper Range. We saw no copper, but these rocks are doubtless the prolongation of the copper-bearing trap and conglomerates found on the Montreal River a few miles above the mouth. The same range is said to continue on towards the west and to rise into considerable hills. The timber is mostly hardwood, but some pine, hemlock, basswood, and so on. As we ascend the ridges, we encounter the ground hemlock, completely covering the ground with their prostrate stems and evergreen foliage and rendering the walking difficult. The botanist said the name of this troublesome shrub was Taxus canadensis, Canada yew. Tripis prostratus would have been a better name, said the geologist as his foot became entangled and he was tripped so as to fall prostrate upon the ground. And September 8, 1858, started with 6 men, 3 packers, to explore the Iron Range eastward from Pinoki, Bad River, which is said to extend 11 miles and perhaps more. On the northeast quarter of 13-44-3, climbed to the top of a log house to get a view of the country, which cannot be had from the trail even on top of the range because of the dense growth of mostly maple trees. A small clearing and an old windfall here enabled us to see off, but only for a short distance. We got no distant view of Lake Superior as I had hoped to do. This could only be done by climbing one of the highest trees or by clearing away a large opening in the dense forest. September 10, 1858, commenced our return journey over the 11 miles of the Iron Range this morning by the examination of the outbreak. On the southeast quarter of section 32, the main ridge seems to terminate here. The rock proved to be a very pure, slaty iron ore, measuring at right angles to the strata, 60 feet in thickness. This ore is nearly all suitable for working into iron. Its slaty structure and brittleness will render it easily worked and broken into suitable size for something. September 11th, 1858. Examined this morning the rapids half a mile below the house, Pinoki. We crossed a short distance below on a tree which we cut for the purpose to the east or right bank, and on returning saw a number of trees that had been felled by the beaver. There is no trace of a dam here, the stream being too large for this purpose. These beaver that build no dams are called bank beaver and are supposed to be of a different kind from the dam builders, but this is probably not the case. The difference is only in habit, owing to different circumstances in which they are placed. Colonel Cutter informed me that he measured a birch tree that had been cut by these singular animals and found at 19 3/4 inches in diameter. The trees I saw were 2 to 5 inches in diameter, maple and birch. Quite a number of these animals are still annually caught in this part of the country. And September 12, 1858. Today we examined the range west of Pinoki as far as the west line of Range 3. From the top of this bluff, about 300 feet high, we had another fine view of the country south extending to the high lands. The whole is covered with trees, and we could only see their tops, or we may say this was an extended view of treetops. I have now traced this iron range from near the east line of Range 1 west of the 4th principal meridian to the west line of Range 3, being therefore across 3 ranges of 6 miles each. We may safely say that here is an iron mountain range 20 miles in length. Judging from the uniformity of the geological formations throughout this whole extent, we may safely infer that the iron ore is also continuous, though often concealed beneath the surface. We had not the time nor means to make extensive excavation in search of the ores, which were not visible upon the surface, but wherever a section could be obtained, iron was found in greater or less quantity, thus confirming the opinion that the iron is coextensive with the range. A pine tree cut in the gap at Pinoki was about 160 feet in height. We saw several temporary tents that had been formed by surveyors and others under which to spend a night. These were made of the bark of the white cedar or hemlock, Abies canadensis, supported by small trees bent over and twisted together like so many arches, or by poles raised on an inclined plane like one side of the roof of a house. These temporary encampments are very quickly and easily made and add much to the comfort of a night in the woods. We noticed some of the log house at La Pointe, where there was an outer protection of bark to form an additional protection against the intense cold of the long winters of this climate and latitude. The northern part of the state of Wisconsin, extending from the central regions, usually known as the pineries, to the shore of Lake Superior, is but little known and its importance but little appreciated by the man of the population residing in the southern part of the state. The small number of inhabitants gives them but little political importance, but yet their rights and the duties of the government towards them are the same as if they had votes enough to attract the attention of political aspirants to office and distinction. And September 13, 1858. Having completed our examinations of the Pinoki Iron Range, we commenced our return journey this morning, went over the same ground as our way out as far as Sibley's, 18 miles, obtained specimens of rocks and minerals on the Copper Range, but no copper. We got back to Ashland at noon and had a pull over the bay so as to get to La Pointe at 7 p.m., just in time to avoid one of those sudden gales that sprung up half an hour afterwards. And this next one is La Pointe, Madeline Island, Wisconsin, September 15, 1858. Remained here all day, waiting for a steamboat. Just at night, got underway on board the North Star, intending to go to Ontonagon. Went only a few miles when the captain decided the lake was too rough for him to proceed, and especially too boisterous to enable him to land at Ontonagon, where there is as yet no government harbor. Accordingly, the boat was run back to La Pointe and lay there all night. The best general view about La Pointe is from the high ridge east of the middle fort, forming the southern extremity of the island. From here, looking towards the west, we see the three places, the old or middle fort, La Pointe, village proper, and Bayfield, all nearly in a straight line, with the bay for a foreground and the distant forest-clad hills for a background. And then Sumner writes, "Increase ends this particular observation with one that calls to mind, if one stands in a similar Madeline Island location, a modern-day scene of piers, sailboats, and perhaps sea kayaks. Back to Lapham, This little bay with its piers, its sailboats and bark canoes, the old Catholic church, the white buildings, and the remnant of the old stockade of pickets all unite to make a very fine and unique scene. And the last few paragraphs of the chapter of Increase Lapham. Less than 5 years after his Lake Superior sojourn, on February 25, 1863, Increase Lapham lost his beloved wife Anne Marie unexpectedly at age 46 to unknown causes. He never wrote about this great loss and likely dealt with her death by working harder on his various projects, watched over carefully by his two daughters, Mary, 24, and Julia, 21. He also had three surviving sons, teenagers Henry and Seneca, and six-year-old Charles. About 12-plus years later, on a warm day in mid-September 1875, Increase celebrated the completion of a draft paper on Oconomowoc Lake. Here at the lake, at a farmstead estate, Miniwoc, he purchased for his children, he decided to end his day by fishing. Taking out a rowboat and fishing pole, he rowed out beyond the lake's marshy edges, not wanting to come in until he succeeded in getting a good string of panfish. He was successful. Around 6 p.m., he rowed back with a large string of fish, but nearing shore, he had to deal with dense emergent vegetation, which required his pushing the boat strenuously with an oar. The exertion proved too much. He collapsed face first into the bottom of the boat, still clutching the oar. His youngest son, Charles, found him. The outpouring of grief was immediate, and newspapers across the state paid tribute. Gone was the state's preeminent naturalist of the times, and a man whose unmatched passion for studying Wisconsin's natural history was saluted across the country. And that's the end of the first chapter in the book of Field, Portraits of Wisconsin Naturalists, Empowering Leopold's Legacy, Volume 1, Can't Wait for Volume 2, by Sumner Mattison, M-A-T-T-E-S-O-N. So grateful to Sumner for all the work he's done to put this book together. Any bookstore will be able to help you find a copy of this book, or make sure they have it at your library. And I'd like to add a note. May we all join our Native American brothers and sisters in protecting all that we have, all the beauty in Wisconsin, all the wild places, including those that bear ore under the soil. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.